and take ourselves up to the 20th century. It's actually really appropriate that we're learning about the Baba Sali today. I didn't realize this when I set up the series, but his yahrzeit is tonight. The 4th of Shvat is the yahrzeit of the Baba Sali, or the Hilula, which is the term that's used among Sfardim for the way that the yahrzeit is celebrated and marked. Thousands of people go to the grave of the Baba Sali in the city of Netivot in the south. It's actually, according to one article that I read, in normal, you know, non-COVID times, they would usually have about 100,000 people come to his grave for the Hilula. It was very funny to me because I read, you know, they had reports about the demonstrations in Tel Aviv, and they said there were 100,000 people who came out. And then I read an article saying, you know, you can get 100,000 Israelis out to pretty much anything. And they showed you headlines from a whole bunch of protests from the last, I forget, 10 years, right-wing protests, left-wing protests, and they all had 100,000, you know, people there at the protest. And apparently you can do it also with some Arak at the Hilula for the Baba Sali. So there's a lot to be said about the Baba Sali, obviously. I actually picked up a couple of books for this purpose. I wanted to start out with two stories. Take a look, please, at source number 8. This comes from a book called Kedoshim Be'eravon Mugbal. I don't know if you're familiar with that term. When you see a name of a company in Israel, the name of the company followed by the letters Bet Ayin Mem. Bet Ayin Mem stands for Be'eravon Mugbal. It's like limited liability partnership, right? It's the equivalent of saying Kedoshim Bet Ayin Mem is like, I think the English translation for it is something like Saints Incorporated or Saints Limited. The book is a little bit of an attempt to remove some of the mystique about the Baba Sali's family, the Abu Chatzera family. But they give a lot of really valuable history that is very hard to find elsewhere and that I believe is accurate. So leaving aside the agenda that appears later on in the book, take a look at the story here in source number 8, which I translated from their book. The book is Hebrew. His father, the Baba Sali's father, Rabbi Masud, who also learned with his children, brought with him also because they're, whatever, it fits in the context, brought with him from one of his trips a beautiful siddur for prayer printed with large letters. When young Yisrael, the Baba Sali's name is Yisrael Abu Chatzera, so when young Yisrael saw the siddur, he asked his father to give it to him. Rabbi Masud loved his middle son more than the others. He gave him the siddur. But first he told him, "See, my son, I read the siddur and I am careful to read it beginning to end without skipping a word. I am concerned that you will not do as I do, and then the siddur will complain against me for giving it away. Therefore I ask you to act with this siddur as I do." Sometime later, young Yisrael came to his father, who said to him, "Today I asked the siddur, and it said it is so happy that I gave it to you, and you do not skip any word or letter. Continue in this path of yours, and God will aid you." This is the way that he is raised. He, from the earliest of ages, in all the stories, you see that he is raised towards the life of being somebody holy. They'll take different forms, as we'll see, but this is something that was in the family, to have certain practices and to identify certain people as potential kedoshim. They're going to grow up to something. And that's an example of how he is raised. Now we fast forward to a story of his from when he's already an adult. And this is a story found on a website in source number 9. There are loads of stories on websites. Someone asked me how I explain all the miracles that are attributed to him. And of course, I can't explain the miracles that are attributed to him. But there are like a million, I mean, a million is an exaggeration, but not by much. stories of miracles involving Rabbi Yisrael Abuchatzera de Baba Sali. It's really, you look online, you'll see story after story after story. I can't explain any of them, but take a look at number 9. Rabbi Yisrael traveled to Tzfat in order to pray at the gravesite of the Tzadikim, the righteous, as well as to pray for the hastening of the final redemption. He traveled to Israel multiple times. With a trembling heart, he approached the tomb of the saintly Arizal, Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, and for the next hour he prostrated on it and cried. Then, after having immersed himself in the frigid waters of the Ari's mikvah, he asked to visit the synagogue where the Ari normally prayed. To his great surprise, access was denied him. The Jewish caretaker of the synagogue, the one who held the keys to the place, told him it had been several years since it had closed down and that no one dared to enter. Those who dared to try never came out alive, he added, concluding his explanation. Rabbi Yisrael reassured him, then asked him to kindly give him the keys anyway. Trembling with fear, the caretaker gave him the keys, all while trying to persuade him that it was best to give up on his plan. A large crowd began to form around the Ari's synagogue, all wanting to witness this event. Tense and fearful, they carefully watched what was about to happen. Rabbi Yisrael took the key and pushed it into the lock of the synagogue's door. The door, which had remained shut for many years, opened with a piercing creak. The spectators' fear began to increase. Rabbi Yisrael turned towards his servant and said, "Grab my coat and follow me. As long as you hold on, no harm will come to you." With emotions running high, the tzaddik penetrated to the inside of the synagogue, followed by his servant who didn't dare let go of the side of his coat. Rabbi Yisrael moved towards the Holy Ark, pushed the colorful veil aside, and opened the doors of the Ark. He took out the Sefer Torah found inside, placed it on the table, then began to read. The servant's heart almost stopped, not knowing if he was asleep or awake. The synagogue then began to fill with a great light, luminous and pure. Rabbi Yisrael turned towards his servant and said, "You can let go of my coat now. Nothing will happen to you. From this day on, everyone can come into the synagogue without any worry." All the Jews who were waiting outside were overtaken with joy when they saw the tzaddik coming out of the synagogue. They had been witness to Rabbi Yisrael's great saintliness. One after the other, they approached the rabbi to kiss the side of his coat and to receive his blessing. So, there's so much to say about the Baba Sali. I'm hoping we get to Rav Mashash somewhat next week. But let's first talk about Moroccan Jewry, the way we've been doing it all along, kind of tracking it with the leaders we mentioned. So we have to take it from the 18th century to the 20th. So in the first half, I didn't give you a year, by the way, for either of these stories, but we'll get to all of it. I mean, he's born, if I remember correctly, and it's in my notes, he's born in 1890. I believe he's 1890 to 1984, if I remember correctly. Yeah, 1890 to 1984. I've seen some listed as 1889. I'm not sure why. So, in the first half of the 19th century, Moroccan Jewry remains unstable in terms of the way that it's being treated by the authorities. We talked about how under the Alawites, there are some leaders who are less harmful and some leaders who are more harmful. No one is like wonderful to the Jews in this period. That's a lot to expect. They're vulnerable to instability within general Moroccan society, particularly during times of war. So you had in the 1840s, the Franco-Moroccan War. That was not good for us at all. And things come to a head with the Spanish-Moroccan War, which is in 1860. The Spanish invade the northern coast of Morocco, specifically a port city called Tetuan, which has a large Jewish community in the Mela. Remember, we talked about the Mela. That's like the ghetto. There's a large Jewish community in the Mela in Tetuan. And the Muslims in Morocco raid the city in order to loot what they can so that the invading Christians coming from Spain will not get anything. So we're going to loot whatever the Jews there have. The Jews did much better when they were living under the Spanish, with the result being that Jews actually celebrated the Christian arrival, right? They were happy when the Christians came. The problem was that when the Christians left, then now what do? Because the Muslims are not happy. So take a look at source number 10 on your sheet. This is from the website MoroccanJews.org, and I felt like it was a good summary of what happened in 1860 and thereafter. In February 1860, Spain prepared to invade the city of Tetuan in efforts to extend its political influence beyond the Mediterranean ports of Ceuta and Melilla. Tribes and unruly soldiers attacked the Mela to protest the impotence of the Sultan against the Spanish. So locals, Moroccans, are attacking under the guise of protesting that the Sultan isn't protecting them. The entire city was pillaged the following day to prevent the Spanish from benefiting from Jewish wealth. In desperation, the Muslim leaders opened the gates of the city to the Spanish soldiers, who took control without fighting. Tetuan remained occupied for 2 years. During the occupation, the Spanish treated the Muslims harshly, but refused to apply Islamic legal restrictions on Jews. In this more liberal environment, some Jews developed close political and business relationships with the Spanish occupiers to demonstrate their gratitude to the Spanish for having taken Tetuan and protected the Jews from further pillage. Tetuan Jews declared a special Purim, the Purim of the Christians, right? Declaring a Purim is something that Jewish communities did when they were saved from some kind of disaster. Well, the problem is, what happens when the Spanish leave? After Tetuan was returned to Moroccan control in 1862, the Jewish population feared it would be attacked, given the close business relationships between some Jews and the Spanish. Taking advantage of this sentiment, European consulates encouraged the Sultan to protect Jews in Tetuan and throughout the country. They saw the Jews as potential allies in increasing European financial, commercial, and political control over Morocco. And then you get an organization which is named in Hebrew Kol Yisrael Chaverim. In French, it's called, as you see on the next line, I'm going to mispronounce it, just like I mispronounce names of Moroccan places, Alliance Israelite Universelle. Is that somewhat close?
Alliance Israelite Universelle.
No. Universelle.
Yeah. Universelle. Yeah. Alliance.
So what it is what it sounds like. It is supposed to be an alliance of Jews from everywhere. And this is an organization that springs up in the early 1860s in response to crises in the Jewish world. One of the crises, we talked about this many years ago, was the Damascus blood libel, in which Jews were accused of ritual murder of a child. Another one was the Edgardo Mortara affair, in which the Jewish baby was baptized. It's a long story, but a Jewish baby was baptized, and then the Catholics wouldn't give him back to his family. They thought the one who baptized him thought he was going to die of an illness, and they were saving him. And then when he survived the illness, they said, well, now he's Catholic. He can't be raised as a Jew. And it was a whole thing, and the Pope would not allow him to be returned to the Jews. And this is you know, modern times. This is the middle of the 19th century. So this organization, Kol Yisrael Chaverim, Alliance Israelite Universelle, is founded as a way to look out for Jews in circumstances like this. So like the Damascus blood libel, like the story of Edgardo Levy, who got renamed Mortara, and like what's going on here in Tetuan. So this group sent an investigation mission to Morocco and concluded life was very difficult for Moroccan Jews. They asked for the French government to intervene. Moses Montefiore of the British Anglo-Jewish Association was asked by the Jews of Gibraltar to negotiate better treatment for Moroccan Jews. In February 1864, he visited Sultan Sidi Mohammed in Marrakesh and negotiated a royal declaration affirming that the Jews would be treated as equals under the law with justice and impartiality, and that anyone mistreating them would be prosecuted. It didn't actually work. Like, there were statements made, but it didn't actually go anywhere. Some European consuls distributed this declaration to government officials, indicating their readiness to protest any mistreatment of Jews. You know, like I said, the records that we have, and I read quite a bit on this show, it was something that was declared on paper, but didn't actually play out in practice. Now, Yeah.
Moses, just to tell you, Moses of the Fury was a very, very influential British Jew.
Yes.
Married to the Rothschilds. I mean,
yep.
And he actually did a lot to help certain people.
Yeah, no, he did. I'm not discrediting him in any way, shape, or form. I'm just saying that in this case, the Sultan and the authorities in Morocco didn't really hold up their end of the bargain.
I also think that in the story of the child,
they never returned
the child.
No, he grew up as a priest.
Yeah.
He grew up as a priest, correct. So Europe gains control over Morocco to a large extent in ensuing decades. The European nations, Spain, France, England, had invested in Morocco, and they wanted to protect their investments. And they took advantage of their investments in order to exert greater control. So in 1880, you get the Treaty of Madrid, which gives European powers control over parts of Morocco. And then in 1912, the Treaty of Fez converts much of Morocco into a French protectorate. It's now really under their control, and the impact on the Jewish community is mixed. On the one hand, Christian control, like we've said, was often better for the Jews. But it resulted in accusations from the Muslim community of wanting the Christians to gain control and helping them. Jews who helped the European powers did get special status, and then the rest of the Jews would suffer for it. And there were particular events and particular problems. Take a look at source number 11 regarding the Treaty of Fez. The Treaty of Fez was signed on March 30, 1912. On April 17th, the Sultan's troops in Fez revolted, but they were unable to enter the European quarter, which was protected by French troops. Instead, the soldiers and a crowd following them pillaged the Mela, right, where the Jews live, from which the French had previously confiscated all weapons, so you can't defend yourself. In order to force the rioters away from the Mela, French soldiers fired missiles and bombs, destroying houses and causing fires. As a result, Jews abandoned the Mela, which was pillaged the next day by villagers. During the 3 days of violence, 51 Jews were killed, 72 were wounded. French troops had a similar number of casualties. Almost 1,000 Muslims were killed or wounded in the fighting. A third of the Mela was destroyed. 12,000 Jews found themselves homeless. So, against that backdrop, we want to talk about the Abu Chatzera family. So, again, much of this history that I'm going to give you, certainly the early history of the family, comes from that book, Kedoshim Be'eravon Mugbal, Saints Limited, by Yossi Ben Mocha and Dani Dor, although I do have some other texts that I'm able to use to fact-check what I'm reading. So, the Abu Chatzera family was not originally called the Abu Chatzera family. They were originally named Elbaz. They came from Granada in Spain, and in 1492, like we've talked about, so many Jews left Spain for Morocco. Actually, there's that number again. Apparently, the records have it as being about 100,000 Jews. There's that number. Going from Spain to Morocco. And they land in Melilla on the northern coast. This was unusual. Many others landed in Tangiers, but for some reason the Elbaz family chooses to go to Melilla. This family claimed to be descended from Yehoshua, from Joshua, the original one. They were not a wealthy family. They were a scholarly family. Now, we've said, I think last time, that the Portuguese controlled the coast of Morocco at this stage. This is going back to 1492. So you don't want to be under the Portuguese as a Jew. You didn't flee from Spain in order to be under the Portuguese in Morocco. So the Jews moved inland. The king of Morocco valued the arrival of the Jews. They brought connections, diplomatic connections, commercial connections. They brought capital with them. And he tells the Muslims not to harm the new arrivals. Right, that's part of what leads to the conflict between the standing Jewish community, the Toshavim, and the Megorashim, the new arrivals who were getting better treatment. So the Elbaz family chooses to remain on the coast, unlike everybody else who's going inland. because there are other members of the family who are supposed to be arriving, but they never arrive. Nonetheless, the decision saved them from harm, because a lot of others who landed with them decided that they were going to take a boat to a different part of the coast and from there go inland, and that boat ended up being destroyed in a storm. And the others didn't make it, but the Albazes, who never went, survived. Now, you can't stay on the coast under the Portuguese. Like, you may think that that's going to be good for you, but ultimately the Portuguese demand conversion. So the Albaz family leaves, and they go to a place called Sefrou, S-E-F-R-O-U. It's in northeast Morocco, near the Atlas Mountains, not far from Fez. It was actually called Little Jerusalem by other Jews in Morocco, because there were many people who were learned in this city. It was also a commercial center. But again, you had problems between the locals and the new arrivals. You had different customs in the communities. North Africans doing one thing, Spanish Jews are doing another. You had certain areas of Jewish law where there were disputes, and the people from North Africa tended to be stricter than the Jews coming from Spain on various issues. There was also a sense that the arrivals from Europe looked down on the locals. Sort of, we're the cultured ones coming in from Europe, we had greater resources, and things aren't going well. And so some of the new arrivals in the city of Sefrou decide that they're going further south in Morocco. And they make their way south, and then they send people, delegation, to get the Albaz family specifically to come with them, because the Albazes are respected for their scholarship. I brought it for you in source number 12. Why did the emissaries strain to travel hundreds of kilometers back to Sefrou to convince the Albaz family to join them? Because the Albaz family were not only artisans and merchants, but also scholars. The Jews who settled in the area saw that they lacked halachic authorities and teachers, chazanim, and slaughterers, and the Albaz family was the answer to that deficiency. The emissary did not have to work hard to convince them. The strife regarding the laws of slaughter, one of the points of contention, led to a rift between the family, the Albaz family, and the Jews of Sefrou, and the rift grew worse, almost to the point of excommunication, and it affected their livelihood harshly. The emissary found the family on the brink of starvation, so it's good for them to head further south. Now, the Albaz family changes their name to Abu Chatzera sometime in the 16th or 17th century. There are lots of explanations that are brought for why. One explanation is because the family traded in a type of mat called a chatzer. So they became known as Abu Chatzera, the father of the mat. Another explanation was that Rabbi Shmuel Elbaz, who was part of the family, went to Jerusalem, and he was known as something of a holy hermit and called Chatzeri. That's another explanation. But the Baba Sali gave an explanation, and this is what we'll do, I guess, to close here. Take a look at number 13. This is recorded in the book Maaseh Nisim about Rabbi Shmuel Elbaz. Once Rabbeinu Shmuel needed to travel across the sea for a mitzvah, he prepared himself and all of his belongings, and he set out on the road. He came to the sea, and there he found a boat traveling to his desired location. Our master approached the captain and asked him to take him on the boat. The captain said to him, "If you'll pay me like all the passengers, I'll take you. If not, not. You gotta pay." Our master told the captain he didn't have any money, and he urged him to take him for free. But the captain, shockingly, did not listen to Rabbi Shmuel's words, and all of his urging was like talking to a deaf ear. He did not let our master travel with him. Our master routinely traveled everywhere with a mat, chatzera, in Arabic. What did he do? He spread out the mat at the seashore and sat on it and began to study, waiting until the boat would set out. All the travelers there saw this and wondered, thinking our master insane, God forbid, but he paid them no attention. How shocked all of them were that when the boat began to travel, our master, sitting on the mat, traveled the sea gently, leaning on his pillow and learning. So because he traveled on the sea on this mat, he became known for the mat as Abu Chatzera. That's what Baba Sali said was the origin of the family's change of name. And Rabbi Shmuel is the first one in the family who has all these legends and stories about him as a kadosh, as somebody of superlative holiness. So what we're going to have to do next time is continue with the story of the family and then talk about Rabbi Yisrael Abuchatzera, the Baba Sali, the stories about him, the influence that he had, and still has, actually, to this day, before we go on to talk somewhat about Rabbi Shalom Mashash. Thank you very much. I'll stick around for questions and comments.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
I just want to say my husband's family came to Morocco from Tunisia when the French came in.
Ah, interesting.
And they were given French citizenship in at that time in Morocco.
What year would that have been?
When your great grandfather came to Morocco, right? When the French came in around that time.
Oh, so 1912, basically.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's a family well-lived.